welcome back, or welcome to join us. Thanks for being here. We just turned down the sound of Salvatore Vitale's night recordings of the related to this work that we have behind us of the return of the wolf. In Switzerland, particularly in the canton Vaud. We had Salvatore, I think it was 2 weeks ago, came here to talk about his work, his bigger series, and so we're very happy to end the first part of Interland, The Eyes of the Lighthouse exhibition, which we'll move on next week. Into Interland, Blood as a Lover, as we move from at least some aspects of concerns of representations to metabolism and the blood, but perhaps this is also something that can be mentioned here in some respects. So we were very happy to have Kuna Harmi with us and Monika Vissina-Jäger to talk this evening about their work and their display here. To start things off, I thought, well, the lighthouse, of course, that we have here with Kuna Harmi is here, we can see behind you inside the Dublin Lighthouse. But as Kuna suggested herself, one way perhaps to connect the Dublin and Singapore might be sand.
Yeah.
In particular, so going to material aspects, but sand seems to be both at the heart of the technology that we see here and at the changing topographies of Singapore. So, Kuna, perhaps can you shall I get it for you?
I was just thinking about where connections were with Monika's work. So Monika's work is here, and my work is here. And one of the photographs there, which is just a new photograph I made recently, is just the kind of, I guess we use them every day, the interior of a barcode scanner, and it has a kind of octagonal shape.
That's the one in the middle.
It's the one in the middle. Just, I suppose, to explain, and I suppose this work is related to other work I've done, so it's kind of a little bit fragmentary. So I kind of was thinking about how something like a lighthouse can connect to the idea of hinterland as well, and how kind of it connects to something like supply chains. So the optic there inside the lighthouse is inside also a kind of red container. So there's a kind of, outside that lighthouse, there's a kind of, it's kind of an octagon-shaped red filter. And then inside that, there's another, filter, which again is made of glass, which is a Fresnel lens. And I suppose glass also has this connection to sand because it's this clear material that's made of sand. But the Fresnel lens is really important in terms of globalization because it was the beginning of once people had, made navigation much safer. So because the light was able to be amplified so that there could be more control about where it was lit and where it wasn't lit. And then as the lenses were put into new places, obviously it would open up supply chains and it would become another hub in a kind of a network. And I suppose something like a lighthouse is also another type of kind of network because they're kind of nodes in a system. And they're kind of, I suppose there's a kind of interesting, because each one has their own kind of almost signature, you know, in terms of the light sequence. It's also got different levels of time. So that was kind of what I was thinking about. And then the other, I suppose, connection with something like the barcode scanner is, and always when I'm looking at work or looking at technologies, I kind of try and read about how were they developed. So the barcode scanner, was developed by this guy, Silverman, and he was a graduate student, and he overheard a conversation of two people talking about that they really wanted to find a way of being able to manage logistics better and find a way of kind of organizing supply chains. So he actually set himself to do this, and he came up with the solution and the ubiquitous barcode that we use today, sitting on a deck chair on a beach somewhere, and he just ran his, and this could be an apocryphal story, because a lot of the stories that we get in terms of the origin of technology are kind of almost like mythic, you know. So, but his story is that he was sitting had been thinking about this for quite a long time, and then he was sitting on a deck chair and he put his hand in the sand and he made this mark from his fingers, and then he thought, well, they actually have different lengths and widths. So he thought about this idea of having, using light and being able to have, so depending on whether the light was reflected back, you could use it as a kind of primitive Morse code. Like, he was actually inspired by Morse code as well, but it's this on, off, and then different lengths of signal. So the kind of non-linear connection, but anyhow, so that's what I was kind of thinking.
Okay, yeah. And SEND is, of course, at the heart of your current research. The material itself also bears some symbolic qualities beside the sort of physical transformation. Can you tell us a little bit about Monica, how you've been looking into this? Land reclamation and the sand trade.
The sand trade in Singapore. Well, there is an interesting connection between land reclamation and the lighthouse in Singapore, because there has been the very waterfront has been an old, very beautiful, rather small lighthouse that was used for navigation. And over the years, when there was more and more land reclaimed, this lighthouse moved further and further inland and became a sort of a relic of what it once served and where sort of the shores at some point had been. And to take it even further, the company Mapletree, who is very much responsible, partially responsible for the development and commercial Singapore, they claimed this lighthouse and said, we want this to be part of our sculpture park at Mapletree. So now this lighthouse sits in this commercial area of this company and is sort of a bit like a stranded whale, or it has become, it's just a symbol of what it once served. And and if you sort of look at its history, you see something that has been removed, not just physically from the shore and from the sand, but also in its purpose, and it's just a mere symbol of what it once was.
We have I was just thinking that because we have in some of the photographs that you included here, thinking about shores, we have this text by Gillis on the history of coastal areas, human shores, and easy at some point. Shores were sort of one of the first places where humans settled, basically. So rather than having a nomadic lifestyle, because you could find food for shells and so on to feed the community. But these, of course, would not be the sand areas, which are not the beaches which were kind of rediscovered in the. Discovered in a new way in the 19th century. We're talking about earlier today of romantic appreciation of the land. So it is sort of a shifting way of appreciating the sort of coastal landscape. But I mean, there's a couple of photographs and of the traditional coastal areas in Singapore. But the sand and land reclamation that we're talking about is a much more physical and hard business affair in this case.
It is. I mean, it's I guess there are two types of sand. I had to learn as well. So there's the river sand and there's the coastal sand. And they are two completely different materials and have different qualities. And I would say where the river sand meets the coastal sand, these are actually the ecological and culturally richest areas, meaning where rivers meet the sea. So the first settlers in Singapore, they settled along Singapore River and the coast, because this was, yeah, sort of the richest in terms of fishing and food supply, and but also trade at some point. And now that all this coastal area of Singapore has either been fortified with concrete,
yeah,
lots of shores have been sort of taken away, and then with concrete and boulders structured in a way that the sea can't take away the sand, mm-hmm, anymore. And those areas who are reclaimed, it's a very big problem that of erosion, and that is also the reason why you can't, if you want to build artificial coastlines, you can't use river sand, because the river sand has the quality of, it just very quickly erodes. You will lose it within a year or so. It's just all gone. So you need a very particular type of sand. And what you see in Singapore is that you have, I talked about the access to the sea this afternoon, so only 7% of the coastline is accessible. And the ones that are either these artificial beachfronts, which provide something like a tropical beach life, but there is one image in the installation. If you're there, the water is very polluted, lots of sand is eroding, and you have the big container ships constantly blocking your view, you know, of that sort of nice, there would be tropical islands at the other side, but you can't see them because you have all these container ships blocking the view. And then the other parts are just concrete walls to prevent the sea from taking away the land and protecting sort of the land that is reserved for the future skyscrapers. So there is a big discrepancy between the idea of the tropical coast and what we expect of it as an image, how it should look like, and how maybe a city like a very touristic place like Singapore wants to promote itself. And there is this one little island in the south called Sentosa Island, which has this artificial, the whitest sand they could find is found there, and but on a daily basis, it's just hard work to sort of maintain this illusion of a tropical coastline. And also it's constantly interrupted because of the life of the port, and you have the horizon that should sort of be the endless, you know, sort of vanishing point is just constantly blocked. Mm.
Just perhaps one thought still with sand, sort of going back to Dublin. So just we're at the end of the south wall here. Of course, Dublin as a site, geographical site, has had a problem with sand for many years, mm-hmm, and it was actually quite a difficult. I mean, I suppose Singapore, places like Singapore, Hong Kong, sort of think, oh, this is a great place to have a port and to have infrastructure for for circulation of ships and so on. Dublin was not so good for that.
Still isn't. I mean, they built this late 1700s, this very big seawall. It was the biggest seawall in Europe at that time, and it's made of stone. It's still there. It's a beautiful wall. But they built it to try and stop sand filling up the shipping lanes. But it didn't quite work. It worked-ish, which a lot of things in places do. But it also caused, what was interesting is it caused another, that made a big change to the bay. So it caused another big island, a big sandbar to grow, which is actually a really beautiful, it's like a kind of nature reserve now where there's a lot of birds and stuff. But so I suppose that there's these shifts in terms of sand when you move one thing. I mean, there was a beach in Ireland as well that had disappeared for 30 years and there was a storm and it had been stony and then had been sandy, then became stony, and then after Christmas one time just suddenly was sandy again after 30 years and it was on, so there was this amazing change. And also when some of the storms came, ruined boats were suddenly found on parts, but these were really serious storms by our perspective. Pretend hurricanes, but there has been a kind of change in weather as well, and that has had a big impact on shores changing.